Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 378th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta. And to set the tone for this, about 2-3 weeks ago, James came to me and he said, Mike, I need help with something and I need someone who's intelligent. And I said, thank you. And he said, I was hoping you could give me Tina's number.
Exactly.
So in the studio with us today is Dr. Koronik. Dr. Koronik, say a little bit about yourself.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Tina Koronik. I'm a family physician and an associate professor at the University of Alberta here.
Right. And so when Mike said I
And a car mechanic.
And
I was just trying to fill in some of your hobbies, but okay, we won't go there. James, why don't you tell us why you needed somebody smart?
Yeah, well, there's so many reasons, but for this one particular reason, what it was the BMJ contacted me and said, we would like someone to write an editorial on the most recent systematic review and meta-analysis that is being done in The Lancet. And this was published back in the third week of February, so about a month ago, almost today. And they said, we'd like an editorial that sort of critiques it, if you will, or at least puts it into a proper context. And so I contacted Mike and said I needed someone smart, and he, as you said, passed me right on to Tina because it's a given. And so the reason that we wanted to do this, and in case you're interested, and we'll put links to all of this stuff in the show notes, is about a month ago, a meta-analysis came out, and it was called A Comparative Efficacy and Acceptability of 21 Antidepressant Drugs for the Acute Treatment of Adults with Major Depressive Disorder, and it was a systematic review in what we call a network meta-analysis. And you guys can comment a little bit on the press. When it came out, a lot of the press made statements such as, now we know that antidepressants work, and millions more should now be on antidepressants, and so on and so forth. And I know you guys saw some of those news reports.
Yeah, I saw the news reports before I read the study, actually. And it's interesting, when I looked to the study, I kept looking for where in the study it said something to support the news reports, but interestingly enough, they didn't seem to correlate very well at all.
Yeah,
as my friend often
I was going to say, the correlation would be close to zero.
Yeah, as my friend always says, the facts, while interesting, are irrelevant.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
So, as many of you know, and as we've probably talked about in for a very long time, is that just because it says so in the press doesn't necessarily make it true, and so. And I think that was almost the context that the BMJ asked us, because it was getting, a lot of, it was very widely reported with a lot of different interpretations. And as you can hear from the words we were using, pretty much an uncritical acceptance of the benefits of antidepressants. And so they asked us, well, could you sort of talk about it and about how you should use this information to inform practice? So I had actually looked at it just quickly because I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting, and I went over it. But then we spent a lot of time going over it in a lot more detail. And so what we thought we'd do is we take this podcast and just go over what we did with that review a little bit, and then put it into the context that we did with the editorial. So so the bottom line is, and Tina, you can comment if you'd like, obviously.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll give you that option. We're going to go through it. So people have heard us talk about systematic reviews and meta-analyses and network meta-analyses. This was probably by far one of the best ones I've ever seen done, in regards to, if you look at all the criteria of what you're supposed to do with a meta-analysis, this one sort of did it. And it's because some of the big names for how you do meta-analyses are actually on this meta-analysis.
Yeah, I would agree, James, but yeah, when we spend time actually reading through this meta-analysis, they were exceptional in sort of clearly delineating what they did and following appropriate protocols. And I thought from that point of view, it was very well done. And you're right, there's some Some people who are very familiar with meta-analysis and write about how to do them properly who were involved in the development of this particular one. So, yeah, it was good.
So they did the meta-analysis pretty much exactly the way that you're supposed to do a meta-analysis. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that just because the meta-analysis is done well, that then you can use the results in a way that are necessarily useful. Because, you know, if you have terrible studies, it doesn't matter how good the meta-analysis is. And I'm not saying that the studies were terrible at all, but do you know what I mean? If it could be a great meta-analysis of not very good studies, and then you have to use the context of that. So what they did is they looked at a lot of, this is probably the largest meta-analysis I've ever seen of antidepressants. There was a total of 522 studies incorporated into it, which was about just between 110,000 and 120,000 people. And it was they looked at a total of 21 different antidepressants. And most of them were not the tricyclics, but they decided to add in a couple of tricyclics because those agents are still used. And they added in clomipramine and amitriptyline. And one of the, unfortunately, they didn't use imipramine because we also see that being used. But so they looked as much as they could at a lot of antidepressants.
A lot.
Yes. 21 to be in, and we don't even need to go through all of them, but there was amitriptyline and escitalopram and mirtazapam and paroxetine and fluoxetine and all of the oxapines and axapines and that are out there.
Yeah, there were some I didn't even recognize.
Frankly, some of them I can't even pronounce.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't even know they existed, but there they are. And you're right. I think that's maybe why it got such big media attention, is it's one of the biggest reviews with, I mean, it looks impressive, just the numbers and the suggestion that, so, I mean, overall, they found that antidepressants were helpful. And so that's what got widely reported,
I think. Exactly. Yeah. Oh, they had an effect above placebo is kind of that sort of
right?
thing. Yeah. No, exactly. And so just to put it in context, so there's 522 studies. And so these guys, this...
Is that all?
Yeah, I know. I was a bit disappointed they didn't go right up to 524. But so here's what's impressive. I mean, this is an incredible undertaking. Mm-hmm. There were 421 of the trials they pulled out from that they were able to find from a database. They actually got 86 unpublished trials, 15 from personal communications, and they also contacted many of the authors of the published trials to get unpublished data from that. So, and again, they did that because that's what you're supposed to do in a really good meta-analysis. So, I don't think there will ever be another meta-analysis that is as good as this one, or there's really no reason to do another one, in my opinion.
No,
not another network meta-analysis.
Yeah.
Not another thing like this.
Yeah,
and a network meta. There will be, James.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, because it's an easy way to get a publication.
This wouldn't be that easy.
No, this one is not an easy one. Yeah,
the ground is laid.
Right, exactly.
You can jump on board afterwards and ride the train.
And so a network meta-analysis just means that we often don't have head-to-head comparisons of every drug versus every other drug. And we use, if you got a placebo drug, a placebo trial of amitriptyline and a placebo drug trial of fluoxetine, you can actually compare the differences to see if you could say one is better than another, even though they weren't compared head-to-head. But that's what they did with a lot of these, lot of the analyses. And
which
so,
is tricky, right, James?
Oh, it is tricky.
There's differences between those populations, and those differences are relevant in outcomes.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So what they did is they did what they're supposed to do, is they looked at the limitations of the included studies, and they rated 82% as having a moderate to high risk of bias. And I don't know about you guys, but when you hear that, what do you guys think of?
Like, I think that's pretty much exactly what I'd expect from the antidepressant literature. So if you set criteria for the study of antidepressants, and I mean, historically, whenever we have looked at publication biases, biases in the reporting of allocation concealment, all of that kind of stuff, it has been highly prevalent in the antidepressant and psychiatric literature period, but particularly antidepressants. So if you look at kind of the landmark studies that have shown trials being hidden and that kind of thing, it's all in not all, but a lot of it started out in antidepressants. So that there's publications in New England Journal, BMJ, some really interesting reads, by the way.
Oh yeah, for sure.
In this regard, so this is, we would expect these to be at least at moderate risk of bias, and they, and other research has shown that there's a, if you look at the absolute benefits, the benefit of having a study funded, whoever funds that study, other research has shown that that gives you about a 5% absolute benefit over the comparator just by funding alone.
And actually it depends what area you're looking at. Like I've seen, that's sort of in the area of depression and some other psychiatric issues, but I've seen critiques of it where when it comes to how effective are statins at changing cholesterol levels, there is no industry bias.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's it's a really tricky thing. And when it says moderate to high risk of bias, that in no way necessarily means that these trials are crap. You know, it just sort of lets you know that when we use the criteria that we use, which are, you know, do they, you know, was it randomized? Was it blinded? Was there allocation concealment and all those sorts of things? There were some absent things, and it doesn't mean that they weren't done properly. It's just they don't report it often very well. Mm-hmm. And then one of the key features that they found is that 78% of the studies were funded by drug companies. And we would expect that as well. And because these smaller trials are often done primarily by the drug companies trying to get their drug on the market to show that it works.
Yeah. And I would say, having looked at now recently a lot of cannabinoid studies with six people for 5 hours, these studies are dynamite.
Yeah.
So these may be small. And certainly I remember one of the very first studies I ever critically appraised as part of my residency was a study of 21 people in a care of the elderly environment with an antidepressant. And when they did subgroup analysis, there were sometimes just single patients, and they put confidence intervals around that patient.
Yeah.
So yeah, some of these are small, but they're certainly not. They certainly fall into a large range because there are some bigger ones in there too.
Yeah. And so I know we looked at this, Tina, and then, you know, it's hard whenever someone says, well, you know, they're funded by drug companies, therefore you can't trust them. We're not saying that, but, you know, we try to find any information about that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, exactly. You can't, it just goes, I think it's important along the lines of what Mike said in the history of depression trials, where we see that funding tends to have a bias in favor of whichever products being funded at the time. Mm-hmm. So that's makes it relevant in this context. There may be something to that.
Yeah. And it's sort of like a declaration, you know, you're just declaring that that's what it was. And we tried to find, you know, specifically if they looked at any, or if they gave details about that. And the only thing that I could find, I may have missed something, but it said somewhere in the article, it says it is somewhat, and this is quoting the authors, is that it's somewhat reassuring that the authors report funding by industry was not associated with substantial differences in terms of response or dropout rates. Now, they didn't give that information anywhere, like they didn't give numbers to support that, but that makes me feel a little bit more comfortable.
See, it makes you feel more comfortable than me, but
yes.
It doesn't have any influence on me, because what is substantive to you?
Yeah, no, exactly.
I know what it means.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a substantive raise next week, James.
No, I totally give you, Are you? Yeah. That's nice. Good.
Yeah,
I'll be looking
forward to it. Substantive.
Yeah. So, and like I said, like we said in our editorial, it is somewhat reassuring, but it doesn't eliminate the issue about the problem that we just talked about.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So what they did is, so we've got all of these, you know, these 522 studies, and they, when you do that, you sort of, first of all, want to look at, well, what population were they looking at? And it's really important to know that this is not mild to moderate depression. The population that they were looking at was adults with moderate to severe depression and an average Hamilton depression score of 26, which is, that's severely depressed.
Yeah, that's certainly, you're not partying, you're not having a good time. Those are patients who, if you were designing a trial, you would target at least early on, because you know the literature suggests that they're the most likely to get a benefit from antidepressants over and above placebo, not because the drug's working better in that population, but because placebo is working less well.
Yeah. Now, because I don't know, because in when you guys see patients there, you don't see a lot of severely depressed, at least in GP land, right?
Some, but certainly.
Yeah, not. I would. So what I think is really interesting about this, meta-analysis is part of that, that it focuses on patients with average scores of about 26, because it's true, I do see severely depressed patients, but by far the most common patient I see is someone with a mild type of depression. Mm-hmm. And that really, it raises an important question, because we do see a lot more discussion in society about, you know, maybe we are under-treating patients with depression. Should we be treating them more? And so, which goes to some of those media reports talking about how everyone should be on this. But you have to be very careful, because the evidence is talking about these patients with severe depression. And, and really important to point out that that maybe doesn't apply to a lot of patients I see in my office who are coming and asking that question. You know, should I be on antidepressants too? Because
it said so in whatever, in the New York Times or in the.
You've missed treating me.
So yeah, why are you such a dumbass?
Have you been in my office lately?
Is that the usual statement? So that's the population. So all the rest of what we're going to talk about is in that population. It doesn't apply to the mild to moderate likely. And certainly not the mild. So what they did is they looked at, many of these studies have different endpoints, but they were able to get a reasonably consistent endpoint to look at. So they looked at their primary endpoint, which was a 50% change in the Hamilton depression score at 8 weeks. So, going from 26 down to 13 or 24 down to 12. See how I did the math in my head? You should be impressed.
Very impressed.
Good. Yeah, I can tell. and then, so they also looked at remission rates. And that is, getting below a certain point on the Hamilton depression score to say that you are now, your depression is in, for lack of a better word, remission.
Is that, what did they use for the cutoff there, did they say?
I'd have to go back and exactly have a look. There was a certain number, but it was different studies use different remission rates.
Yeah. So I think they had different definitions.
So if a study said this is what we defined as remission, they just thought that was a person who was in remission, if you know what I mean. And then they looked at two other endpoints, and that was all-cause discontinuation, which is really a measure of acceptability and tolerability. So if it doesn't work, you might end up stopping it. And if you don't tolerate it, you might end up stopping taking. So that's all-cause discontinuation. And then they also looked at the dropouts due to adverse events. So that's the number of people who had to stop because of an adverse event. But nowhere in there do they report anything on the specific adverse events. And that's or adverse effects, which is really an important piece of information that you need. And it's not the fault of the meta-analysis that they just didn't report it or look at it, because one, it's tricky to get.
It's also, because of the number of studies, because of the network in a network meta-analysis, it becomes really tricky in reporting individual outcomes. So the majority of network meta-analysis do this kind of dichotomous endpoints that they feel can apply broadly, like a 50% reduction, and people who can't tolerate the medicines, because it's much simpler given the complexity of the math that's underlying all of this, because there is a lot of comparisons going on and a lot of numeric rating.
So when they do all of that, and when you put in 120,000 patients, and the drug actually probably has a bit of an effect, every antidepressant showed that it worked. And by that, it means that the odds ratios, and we'll talk about odds ratios in a minute. I don't know why they did that, but they used odds ratios. But every one showed that there was a statistical change in the odds ratio in an improvement in the number of people who had a 50% reduction in Hamilton depression score. And that was right the way across the board. And the odds ratios ranged from 2.13 for amitriptyline, which was the highest. I'm not saying it's the best, but it was the highest, down to 1.37 for reboxetine. But they all show statistical difference. So that's where you hear that all these drugs work.
Yep.
And so that all has to be put into the proper context. So they also showed that I think almost all of them, when you looked at the odds ratio, showed a reduction in remission. And so there's these big forest plots where you can see how all of the drugs did. And the problem is trying to figure out which one worked better. And, if you go back and look at those forest plots, you know, and we looked at those. There's yep. a big overlap in all of the confidence intervals. So it's really, really hard to say that one was necessarily better than another.
Which I thought was, a really important point, that idea of the point estimates might vary, but yeah, the confidence intervals are just overlapping like crazy. So how, yeah, we can't confidently say
exactly
much.
Yeah, about
that would never stop us.
No.
That would never stop us.
Yeah, so now we'll rant for what it actually showed. So so what we did is, and I don't know about what you guys think, so I don't know why they decided to use odds ratios. I still struggle to know why.
But many people do in these big meta-analyses. There's a serious love affair with odds ratios in meta-analysis, regardless of whether the events are common or anything. Mm-hmm. And it's just a really interesting behavior among statisticians to gravitate towards an odds ratio when it's less applicable in practice.
Yeah. And so because of that, so here's what we did. We said, well, and actually the authors state, and again, you guys are not going to be very comfortable with this. It says they found few differences between antidepressants when all data were considered. So,
it just sort of hidden in the middle there somewhere. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Now that's probably partly because of the overlap, you know, of all the confidence.
Yeah, exactly.
So we took them at their word. And what we did is we took all of the odds ratios for all of the drugs and sort of added them all together to get a ballpark average odds ratio for antidepressants in, you know, globally or combined. And so the odds ratio for the 50% reduction in the Hamilton Depression Score was 1.66, and for remission it was 1.56. And now that we've told you that, you have all the information you could possibly want, because it's so easy to get absolute numbers out of that, right, Mike?
Yes, easy, especially in the odds, using the odds.
Oh, it's yes. Really, yeah.
So you'd average that out to be about a 1.6 odds ratio, right?
Yeah, 1.66 for the...
1.66 and 1.56, so somewhere around 1.6 overall.
Yeah.
And then you take that and you apply it to what and to get what?
Yeah, exactly. And is that a question or, because I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's somewhat of a question, but it's tricky. You can't use, there are online calculators now where you can, if you have the baseline risk, you can input an odds and they will give you the absolute benefits, that kind of thing. But it's not. They're not easy. They're not intuitive.
Yeah, I was going to say the word is not intuitive is mildly exaggerating the thing.
Yeah.
But yeah. So what we had to do there was, so to put it into a sort of the proper relevant context, is you have to know what goes on in the placebo group. And so Bruce Arrell and others, but, you know, a good friend and colleague, Bruce Arrell, has done a lot of looking at this in depression trials. And you roughly get about a 30 to 40% placebo group response in the people who get obviously put on placebo. Some studies are upwards of 50%, but we use sort of that 40-ish percent to put it into context. And then exactly as you said, Mike, there are online calculators. You can go in and go, well, if that is the baseline, what happens if it's an odds ratio of 1.6? And what that ultimately means is, roughly speaking, somewhere around 10 to 12% more people in the treatment group would get a benefit compared to the placebo. And so knowing that, you can do the numbers needed to treat is roughly 8 to 10. And lo and behold, that's the exact number that we've been saying for years, and so is every other meta-analysis.
And it's interesting, you should point out here that 1.6 odds ratio, if you use that as if you just said, well, it's the same as a relative risk, and you apply that to the 40% that you have, the absolute increase in people attaining remission would be well over 60%, and your number needed to treat would be less, that would be five or less. Yeah. And so this is the danger of using odds. If you automatically assume, as many people do, that the same as a relative risk. And I've actually seen that in big journals.
Yeah.
In the actual results, they talk about odds, and then in their conclusion, you know, we found a 60% odds ratio, and therefore this helps people attain remission. 60% more people attain remission, and it is absolutely not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why we had to do this sort of almost a reverse calculation.
Yeah, it is a reverse calculation.
So now that we know that, so what that tells you is, and I think this is a really useful piece of information. So in essence, and again, we've talked about this when we talked about antidepressants in the past, is if you give an antidepressant to a person, about 50% of them will report a benefit, which is not bad, right?
I mean, it's good.
You have very few things that you get that sort of a benefit. However, 40% of the 50%, it's not really 40% of the 50, but work with me. Mm-hmm. 40% of people, if you would have done, just given them a placebo, would have had a response. So even though a person comes in and says, I'm feeling better, you know, most people would go, well, thank goodness it's the drug working. Well, you know, 80% of the people who say they're feeling better, like that's the 40% versus the 50%, it's not because of the medication. I know it's very confusing, and I know you're all depressed by just hearing the numbers. Yeah.
I just love you going through these numbers because it's playing right into your wheelhouse.
Oh, I know. So the bottom line is, and I think is about 50% of people will feel better on an antidepressant, and it probably wasn't because of the antidepressant.
But as a clinician, you'll say, look how much better I've made you.
Yeah. Yeah. You come across as a genius.
But, and remember, this isn't just moderately to severely depressed patients. So yeah, the number of them even getting better on placebo is impressive. It's a good reminder for people.
No, exactly. So that's that was the benefit. So now we know what it shows. It doesn't, I don't think, have we mentioned that millions more people should be on these drugs? I don't think we mentioned.
I think you did when you said 50% of 80% is 20% of 30.
Yeah. And if you
1.6.
Yeah, if you carry the 2 and then take the square root of it.
I don't know whether you're using sine or cosine with that.
Oh, it's so difficult to know.
I'm still with you.
So that's the efficacy. And again, that really is no different than every other meta-analysis we've ever seen on this.
No, these numbers, James, never let repeating the same findings over and over again stop someone from saying their findings are revolutionary.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And they didn't say revolutionary, but this was very well done. So then they look at, so what about all-cause discontinuation rates? So, you know, we talk about, you know, efficacy plus tolerability, and they found that there was, they were not statistically different from placebo. So in other words, the side effects did not overwhelm the benefit or vice versa. I think that's kind of how you'd interpret it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now when they looked at they gave an odds ratio of the chance of dropping out because of side effects, and the odds ratio was around 2.3, which means when you put it into the reverse logic math that we just talked about, in placebo, about 3 to 5% of people will drop out because of side effects. And roughly speaking, you're doubling it, roughly, to about, you know, instead of 3 to 5, maybe 5 to 10% of people will drop out because of adverse events. So we're talking about probably about a 5% absolute increase in the number of people who will drop out because of side effects, which are due to the drug. But that also tells you, if you get a person who is complaining about side effects of the medication, there's a 50-50 chance it may not be the drug. It may just be something else going on.
Well, yeah, we have to remember what side effects were actually, what happens in these trials. So you get enrolled in a clinical trial, you're started on a new drug X, you've been in it for 2 weeks, you're driving home, you get in a motor vehicle crash. That's a side effect because you got somehow led to a crash. You get a severe headache that ends you up in a merge. It may have nothing to do with, or you might even be in the placebo group.
Yeah.
But that counts as an adverse event. And so all of our adverse events, so common cold, like rhinitis and stuff, is very common finding in reported in clinical trials for this kind of thing. And a lot of that is sorted out by the trial investigators. But there's still, these things are much more common. Because things are very common, they also can look common in the adverse events. And that's why we always have to warn patients when they're reporting, but there's all these adverse events that have been linked to this medicine or have been found in this medicine. That's because they occur anyway.
Yeah. And here's what was tricky, and Tina, you and I, we hunted for this a little bit, is that they were not consistent in how they use the word adverse events and side effects. Mm-hmm. You know, and many of the clinical trials aren't. you know, I always think of and this is just my own definition. Side effects are things like the dry mouth and the sedation and so on. And you know, I think remember we were talking about this. We struggled going, are they talking about adverse events or side effects? And sometimes they use the terms interchangeably, so it was a bit confusing for sure.
Yeah, you're right. When we looked at some of the graphs in the appendix too, yeah. The terms were used interchangeably, so it was hard to sort of parse that out. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think they meant side effects. Mm-hmm. But I'm not 1,000% sure. So there you go. So that's what this meta-analysis, it was meticulously well done. I think most people would agree.
Yeah, and when I said that they, you know, reporting something as revolutionary, I didn't mean necessarily the authors. I meant more how the media interprets these things.
Yeah, and it's not, and we can just blame the media, but there's a lot of other people we should blame as well. I mean, it's this also clinician, and it was all right across the board.
I blamed you.
Of course you did. Yeah. So that's the bottom line. That's what this meta-analysis showed. I think it, like I said, very well done. And I think at least in our editorial, that the key issue though is that we said, and perhaps most importantly, here are the questions that the meta-analysis does not answer. And if you can just bear with me, I'm just going to go through them, because these are key things. I think we'd all agree that every one of these you need to know the answer to if you're going to make decisions in at least in for, you know, for patients with depression. So one, we don't know if these results apply to people with milder forms of depression. We didn't actually mention this. These studies, they only look for 8 weeks. So we have no idea if what happens after 8 weeks. And I'm pretty sure most people I never heard of anyone just being depressed for 8 weeks. I mean,
most guidelines would say to go beyond 8 weeks for sure.
Nine months to 12
yeah.
months.
Yeah, before you would even say you're. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's before you'd say I'm going to withdraw. I'm going to try you off this medicine. So, and obviously that changes based on how many episodes you've had and everything. But even if this is your very first episode, most advocate for continuing for 9 to 12 months.
Right.
You know, they don't talk about the harms associated with the specific agents or the magnitude of them. They don't talk about the effectiveness of antidepressants outside the confines of a randomized trial. And there's nothing, and it's not the fault of the meta-analysis. We don't have that data.
Yeah.
And it didn't consider the long-term adverse effects of antidepressants, the likelihood of withdrawal symptoms when treatment stops, the comparative benefits and harms of antidepressants relative to non-drug treatments such as CBT and so on. And it literally cannot tell us which antidepressant should be tried first or which one is likely to work best for an individual patient. So other than that, we now have very good answers.
Yes.
And it's amazing. So that's, you just look at the number of trials that have been done. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about that in other contexts too. We see trial after trial after trial, but they are still not answering questions that are important clinically to us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have some, the meta-analysis doesn't give us any of those answers. We do have some answers for some of those questions that I gave you, but when we're saying outside of this meta-analysis, it doesn't do that. So we do have some information about withdrawal and you know, non-drug treatments and so on. But what I'm just trying to say is that the meta-analysis didn't give us that. So that's why we can't say millions more.
But that's science, right? That's science, though, right? Like, you can't address every question in your systematic review or RCT or...
No, but what would be nice, and it's not, again, not their fault, is, and they do actually mention some of these things in their meta-analysis, saying this only applies to this. So, like I said, I when I read the results and even their conclusions, they pretty much said what the meta-analysis said. It was just distorted by everybody else who read it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's common. You know, you've written articles, James. I've written articles. Tina's written articles. And when you read the press release on your article, you're like, that's nothing at all that I was intending to say.
No, exactly.
And some of them are horrific when you see them in print. I'll never forget one of the first studies I did was on what do doctors know about healthcare costs. And the headline was something about doctor in University of Alberta says that physicians don't know anything.
Yeah, well, you've said that in the past, but not in that article.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd be saying anything like that. And so it was fascinating. You're like horrified to, oh my God. And then you see your name in print right underneath that title.
Yeah. And then your mother phones you up and says, did you say that? You know, we've said not to say those things anymore.
Yeah. It's horrifying. Oh, so they're what you intend people to interpret out of. I think you told me one time that the article that you've written on aminoglycosides has been used as a reference for doing levels of aminoglycosides, and your entire argument was it should not be done.
Yeah, just it drives you mad, and you just eventually give up and go, what's the point? But you know what? It gives us all a job.
Yeah.
Because if everything worked and if we all used them properly, there'd be no point in having the best science medicine podcast or anything of the things that we do. So anyway, we thought you guys might find the discussions somewhat useful about this meta-analysis and also sort of the nuances of how it's tricky to figure out what to do with this information. So hopefully we did a reasonable job. We'll put links to everything. And Tina, thanks for helping out with all that, because it's always nice to have, you know, more than just one pair of eyes on these sorts of things, and it's kind of, these are fun things to kind of put together.
Yeah, it is. These are really fun, because it's great to be able to look at the research and look at how it's been reported and just try to clarify some of that.
Yeah, and the nice thing about it, they don't send it out for, well, they do actually. I shouldn't say they don't send it out for peer review. They do internal review, and they in fact had a statistician look at what we wrote. But the nice thing is you're pretty sure they're going to accept your publication, in contrast to almost every other thing I send journals. Mm-hmm. So it's nice that way. So anyway, hopefully you found the discussion interesting. We would love it if you would, as you know, we've got a course coming up here in Vancouver, May 4th and May 5th. And it's rapidly selling out. It's not quite sold out, but we're getting there. So we would love it if you would attend, or if you're considering attending, we suggest you do that. I think there's still a bit of a early bird. It's sort of not the earliest bird, but there's another early bird savings. The medium bird.
Okay.
And when you come to the course, Mike will flip you the bird. So we have a lot of fun in these sort of things. We do actually say in front of 400 people. So we would love it if you would show up. Mike and Tina and Mike will all be there with all
Adrian
sorts of...
will be there.
Adrian will be there. I apologize for not adding that in. Yes, for sure. And so we'd love it if you'd show up. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening. How about this? Thank you as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.